Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 1st, 1998. In the Creekside Room this morning, we have session number 98-3 by Bruce Berner. It's entitled, Why Won't the Judge Let the Jury Hear the Really Good Stuff? Let's listen in.
Nice to have you all here. I think we can roll the tape at this point. We can say this to the invisible rollers of the tape, spinners of the spear, whatever we call them. My name is Bruce Berner. I teach at the law school at Valparaiso University in Indiana. And the subject we're going to talk about today is a subject that law students confront in their second year in the course called evidence. And we're going to be looking at some aspects of what we talk about in that course. But the way I build it is, why is it that the judge never lets the jury hear the really good stuff? Undoubtedly, you have been sort of frustrated by this from time to time, watching trials or following trials in the newspaper. It always seems as if there are two stories. The real story that has all kind of facts and texture, and people have actual backgrounds, and people have this past that the press is willing to tell us about. But then we notice when we get into the courtroom, a lot of that never appears. And it always looks as if the lawyers are trying their best to get the whole story to the jury, and the lawyer on the other side, together with the judge, are stopping them, as if there is something too dangerous about this information in the hands of the jury. And what I want to talk about today are a couple of the things that are going on when the judge says the jury can't hear this evidence. Let's start by recognizing that the situation is a whole lot better today than it was in the past in this country, or than it ever was in England, which is, of course, where we got our legal tradition. By the time what we would call modern trials started with a more modern jury system, the rule in England was, for the most part, the jury shouldn't hear much of anything. You carefully control everything that goes to them, and the presumption was that the jury can't hear it. Why? Anybody want to guess why we didn't want the jury to decide it?
So the judges could make a decision.
Yeah, so that's in part. It was a kind of a notion that the judge was more educated than the jury. There were certain things the jury just couldn't understand.
Well, I've often wondered if it was because if you really had a jury of your peers, they probably knew all that stuff about you anyway.
Yeah. It's interesting.
So you don't need to, it's like, you already know who this person is. We don't need to spend time on that.
And to a certain extent, that's true today. Even though the community is bigger, the media performs the same function as town meetings used to perform. So what juror would go sit down in O.J.'s case and not have some sense of who he was and what the past was? Right? When the Watergate case came about, at that time there was a rule that if you knew anything about the case, you couldn't sit as a juror. What would you think of 12 people who knew nothing about what?
Uneducated.
In Nepal for the last 2 years, or ill or something, but there was a time where the qualification to sit as a juror was that you did know something about it. That you had some specific way to help. Either you had a particular expertise or you knew the actual facts of the case. In other words, at one point, the witnesses and the jurors were the same people. And another time, England had a period where it went through wager of law. Wager of law was a wonderful concept. In a criminal case, the defendant could win the case by waging law. And waging law was you brought 12 people in with you, and they all swore that you were a wonderful person and couldn't have done this. And if you got 12 who would do that, you won. In other words, it had nothing to do with anybody having to prove any facts or disprove them. You just got 12 people to come in and swear. Now, it turns out, you know, most of us look at that and go, phew. Steve Martin does a wonderful burlesque of this, in which he steps away from this because they're trying people by ordeal and coming down slides of the way we used to try witches, and says, I have this idea of a jury, 12 people, who just look at the facts, who decide what's right. Nah! And then they go back to running people down the slide. Well, the interesting thing about Wager of Law was, it wasn't easy to get 12 people to come in and put their hand on a Bible and swear, because the belief system was that there was a lot to pay for doing that false. And that if there were 12 who would say that, with that kind of belief system, you probably were not guilty. Today, right, we wouldn't want to trust to that, so we trust to something a little bit different. The presumption today is that evidence will be admitted, that the jury will hear it, unless there is some particular rule that can be cited that shows evidence shouldn't go to the jury. Now let's look at what some of those are. First of all, we don't let the jury hear evidence if it's irrelevant. Right? That makes perfect sense. It's easy to say. The problem is, what do we mean by relevant? And it turns out that something's legal relevance is very different from its human relevance. There are many things we want to know as humans to sort out a dispute that the law says, well, that's not relevant. Let's take a very simple case, a victim suing a driver in an automobile collision. And the only issue in the case is, was the driver careless? That's the only issue we have to worry about. Everything else can be easily proved. Everybody agrees to the damages and everything else. So the only question is, was driver careless or negligent, right? So here we have the case of victim versus driver. The only issue is the driver's negligence, and I want to ask you about the relevance of some things. How about this one? The fact that the driver was going 48 miles per hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone.
Relevant.
Sounds relevant, right? Because that tends to indicate whether the person was careful or not on a given occasion. Not only do reasonable people not exceed the speed limit by 18 miles an hour, although speed limits are a very interesting study in what the law says and what the law is. Right? There's always this sort of secret tolerance that we all talk about. Well, the police, in fact, if you go to different places in the country, you hear different things. But often I've heard people say the police can't stop you until you do more than 10 miles in excess of the speed limit. Well, it's not true. There are some practical reasons why they don't, because the proof is too slippery with radar, that kind of tolerance. But my own experience driving around, and most of your experience driving around, is if you had just come in from Venus and drove around, and that's what you did, and looked at the limits, you would assume they were posting the minimum speed. Right? That's what it seems like, right? So two things are relevant about he's going 48 miles an hour. First, careful people don't go that far over the speed limit. And second, there's a law against going over the speed limit. So
there's prima facie.
Huh?
You're in Washington anyway, and I don't know about other states, but there's prima facie speed limits in Washington.
Per se, right.
That means that depends on the conditions.
You're talking too fast, right. I can't understand it.
That's the maximum under ideal conditions. Right? Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. My understanding is that it can go either way. That you can be ticketed for going under the speed limit if it's dangerous to go. Oh.
Correct.
Or you can also argue in court that it was safe to go 18 miles over the speed limit under the conditions that were prevailing at the time.
Oh, that's interesting. Most states won't take that kind of defense. That the rule is more rigid, that you can't say there are situations where you might have an emergency. If you're taking someone to the hospital who's gravely ill, then there may be some excusing condition. How about this one? The driver was not wearing his prescription glasses. That sounds like it ought to come in.
License is restricted.
Let's say his license doesn't bear a restriction. He just sees better with the glasses on. A little slipperier.
It depends on whether it's for distance or not.
Let's assume they help him at distance, but his license bears no restriction that says he can't drive without them. but it helps him to drive with him.
And did he get these glasses since he got his driver's license?
Let's say he had the prescription changed, and he's got them with him. They're in the car, and they're just on the dashboard. He just didn't put them on because he doesn't look quite so cool. Come on.
That's
right?
If I was a prosecuting attorney, I'd try to get it in.
The plaintiff, right? This is a civil case. Yeah, and you would try to get it, and you would get it in, because it at least tends to show that he wasn't as careful as he could have been. It doesn't prove he was negligent, but evidence doesn't have to prove something. It just has to tend to prove. It just has to make it a little more likely to be true, because you build up a case not with one piece of evidence, but with a lot of different pieces of evidence put together.
So you said before that we're only trying to determine whether or not he was careless. We don't have to worry about whether or not it was a causative factor in the.
We're going to assume all of those things are true. All we're concerned about is, was he careless? Right. But all those other things have to be proved. I just want us to assume that the causation and the duty and the damage can all be shown separately.
Okay.
Okay.
But we don't have to assume that the fact that he wasn't wearing glasses was a causative factor in the.
Eventually, but not for purpose of this. We just want to know if it shows him, tends to show him as careless for not wearing it. The driver was talking at the time of the accident on his cell phone. Yeah, sure, it's relevant. Does it mean that every time you talk on your cell phone and drive, you're negligent?
Yes.
Well,
I live in Los Angeles, and the answer is yes.
And I live in California.
Well, occasionally I go into Chicago on the Dan Ryan in the morning, and occasionally you will see people drinking coffee and on the cell phone. And so driving the car is the very last
priority.
And, well, they're listening to the radio. Yeah. And Mike Royko, some of you may know him. He died about a year and a half ago, but he was a columnist in Chicago who had quite a following.
Syndicated.
Very irreverent sort of guy. And he suggested that you get in front of one of these people on the Dan Ryan and then jam your brake lights on. And just sort of watch the hilarity as the coffee and the cell phone and everything. What Mike refuses to tell you is, of course, you're the one they're going to run into if you do that. All right. How about this one? 2 years ago, driver beat up a nun.
Oh,
no.
Why am I laughing?
Driver, 2 years ago, beat up a nun.
Irrelevant.
Legally, it's not relevant because it doesn't tell us anything about whether he drove carefully or not. In other words, there's no particular connection, logically, between violence and care. Are you all persuaded of that, or do some of you think maybe we want to know this?
Well, if he was convicted of a felony in that regard, and he testifies about his careful driving in the case, then you can use that to impeach his credibility.
Absolutely. That's one place where we would hear about it in the case in which the defendant chooses to take the stand. Because once the defendant, in this case, chooses to take the stand, something else becomes important. Not just is he careful, now it becomes important, is he credible? Is he trustworthy? And so you're absolutely right. If he would take the stand, we may hear about that, but the judge would say, look, ladies and gentlemen, this beating up the nun business, that has nothing to do with whether or not he was careless here. I want you to understand that. I want you to consider that only on the question, was he telling the truth as a witness here? Now, that's a real interesting question, and people have tried to research, can juries do that? Do juries do that? That is when the judge tells them, gives them an instruction like this, you just heard all this testimony, please disregard it. You've just seen a film of the defendant killing everyone, well, we'd like you to disregard that. And you know, psychologically, how much can it be disregarded? How careful can the jury be? Interestingly enough, most of the studies indicate that the juries do follow those instructions. As hard as it, I've always said there's two great fears that we have about studying the jury too carefully. One is the fear that they have no idea what they're doing. But the greater fear is that they know exactly what they're doing. You know, and in a sense, they bring more to it than the law gives them credit for. How about this one? While in college, Driver cheated on his final exam in ethics. Well, now, again, if he takes the stand, we're going to get him with that, right? But what if he doesn't take the stand?
I'd say it shows great care.
That's right.
You have to really work to cheat.
That's right.
It depends on whether he got his degree or not.
The interesting thing to me here is that, let me give you one more. All of victims spare time, the person who was hurt in the accident, is spent volunteering at a local orphanage. All of victims spare time is spent volunteering at a local orphanage. It's irrelevant, yeah, and yet
it's going to come in. That's where he was headed at the time of the accident.
Yeah, lawyer's going to try to figure out a way to what we call float that to the jury. And you were going down Route 66. Yes, I was on my way to the orphanage where I worked. Here, real quick, my Jackson. Oh, okay. Please disregard that, right? That's, and actually, that's unethical for a lawyer. If a lawyer knows that the jury's not supposed to hear that, it's unethical to float it to the jury without the judge's approval. And there's some legal techniques to make sure that doesn't happen. The interesting thing to me about the orphanage thing and the beating up the nun, neither of which is legally relevant. And unless there's some sort of floating going on, the jury will not learn about that. Isn't there a sense in which we want to know those things?
Yeah.
To get the whole story?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, is there a human sense that doing justice here maybe has more to do with, was he as careful as he could have been? You say, no, good. You good?
I don't think so.
Good. Okay. So your sense of what is relevant is very much aligned then with, if this doesn't connect to a legal issue that's relevant in the case, right, we really oughtn't to hear about it. How many of you saw a movie called My Best Friend's Wedding?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not too many. It's a wonderful example to me of sort of relevance in one sense and relevance in another sense. This is a sense in which the star Julia Roberts has been prompt, had a deal with this guy that if neither one of them was married by 10 years from now, they might get married then. The movie starts with her receiving a phone call from him, this is 9.5 years later, that he's being married in 2 months. She now travels out there. And basically what she tries to do is undo the pending marriage, right? A fair statement of the movie. Now, at one level, if you haven't seen the movie, you would say, well, that's awful. This man and lovely young woman are trying to get married, and here's this person from his past trying to intrude. Problem is, if you see the movie, you begin to root for Julia Roberts. Because she's the star, she's funny, you've seen her in other movies. They paint the pending bride as kind of naive and brash and silly and all this. And what we finally end up doing there is letting these, what I call, soft facts color our perception. And by the end of the movie, I actually was very uneasy. It was actually, I mean, most people said, what a hilarious comedy. And I thought, no, this is not. This is kind of. This is an attempt to make us like what, at one level, is the villain in the story. Jerry Spence used to say, the way you win a murder case, if you're going to win a murder case and you're the defendant, is get the jury so that when the trial is over, they like the defendant better than the deceased. In other words, these things are all legally irrelevant, but human beings, you know, our sense of justice is a little broader than that. All right. Let me give you one other, before we go to the board, let me give you one other kind of case where the law keeps things from the jury, and it may not immediately, you may not immediately see the purpose, but let me work with it. I want us to assume that a shopper is coming out of Kmart with a very big bag, because you can buy a lot of Kmart, right? And she comes out of Kmart carrying this bag and bumps into a post which is set, which is about this high off the ground, and it's set there to keep cars from running up on the sidewalk. The problem is when you come out of Kmart and you have a big bag in front of your face, you can't see it too well, so she hits this post, falls and hurts herself. And now brings a civil action against Kmart, claiming that this is a negligent way to construct this post. And the lawyer will have all kind of theories. The post should be further away. It should be higher. It should be painted a brighter color. It should have some protective mesh around it so it's not so sharp, etc. Right? That case is filed, and it's going to be tried in, say, 3 or 4 years. The Kmart officials now say, boy, you know, we didn't see that this could happen, and this could happen again, and so they get a crew out there, and they take the posts up, and they, in fact, move them 2 feet further away from the door, and they make them higher, and they paint them optic yellow, and they put some other things around so it's not so easy to bump into them. Now, at the trial, one of the things that the plaintiff, the woman, wants to tell the jury about is that Kmart fixed it 3 months after she fell. Is that relevant?
It's an admission of guilt on the part of Kmart, isn't it?
Yes, right, that's the theory.
But it also showed good faith on the part of Kmart that once they realized it was bad, they fixed it.
But they realized it was bad, and when she fell, it was before they realized it, so their actions of fixing it appear to be, as you say, an admission that it was a dangerous condition to begin with. Now, here's the problem. There's a rule in this book, right, which is the Federal Rules of Evidence, but almost every state follows the same pattern. You have them out here? Yeah. Okay. Almost every state follows. And the rule says the jury can't hear about this. It's called the rule on subsequent remedial measures. The jury cannot be told that the defendant changed the condition after the accident. Now, we're keeping that information from the jury. And it's relevant information. Because if it hadn't been an unsafe condition, Kmart probably wouldn't have changed. They would just say, well, this lady.
No, let's go.
I was you know, being a little bit facetious when I said that it was a mission of guilt. Because in my way of thinking, because we have such a litigious society, they could take those remedial actions just to prevent somebody else from taking that legal action without actually admitting anything about the dangerousness of the situation.
It's true that it doesn't prove that the situation was dangerous, but it tends to. For example, what if someone sued Holden Village because they walked in here, and here's a chair in the middle, and they weren't watching, and they fell over it. And their theory was, you should have no chairs. Adjust floors, you can sit on the floor, can't fall off the floor, that's another great thing, that's why I sit on the floor.
Can't hear.
And so, now, would Holden Village remove all the chairs? No, of course they wouldn't remove all the chairs because they would say, we think that's a crackpot idea, everybody has chairs. In other words, there's a little hint, at least in there, that if they change the condition, they're agreeing, at least in part, that there may be some merit. I agree with you, though, it doesn't prove that it was dangerous. In fact, things that are not negligent, things that are not negligent can still be made safer.
Well, just let's go to the famous hot coffee case.
Yeah.
You know, I got a cup of coffee the other day someplace, and I counted that 13 places it said on that cup and
right.
the cover, hot.
Caution, hot surface, hot liquid.
Could be hot.
Right.
I thought, This is ridiculous.
Right.
I ordered coffee. Coffee
right.
comes hot. It says on here 13 times, but it says it in English every time. Now, what if...
Right.
You know,
right.
You, this can get absurd.
Well, the problem... Yeah, and that's right. And the problem is that the warning doesn't match the problem. Everybody knows coffee's hot. That's why you buy coffee. The problem with the McDonald's case is not that the coffee was hot. The problem with it was that the coffee was 200 degrees.
Okay.
When 160 degrees is hot enough to drink.
Would do. But but I didn't buy this at McDonald's. So I buy it somewhere else. So, I mean, I think it's the same logic there that, you know, at Starbucks, they don't serve their coffee at 200 degrees, but because McDonald's got sued, they decide they're going to write on their cup 13 times hot.
Right. I know. People, but you see, there's no cost to that change. There's very little cost,
very little
marginal cost. Removing all the chairs from Holden Village is a huge cost. Nobody can sit down. That's what I'm saying, right? So, companies will always choose the cheapest fix they can that gets the job done. So warnings are easy. The problem is warnings usually don't work.
Yeah, but I guess, well, never mind.
All right. What the federal rules say is this. The reason we don't want the jury to hear about the remedial measure, and one of the reasons is it doesn't necessarily prove negligence. That's true. But you can argue that it does, is this. What would happen if we were going to tell this to the jury? What would happen? Kmart may not ever fix the post. Because they know if we move the post, we're going to get lathered with this in the courtroom. So let's take a shot at just leaving the post where they are and hope nobody else falls. Maybe we'll put up some signs. But we won't actually take any effective measures. So the rule on subsequent remedial measures says, we want to help society by getting these changes made. We want to create an incentive for the companies to make the products or the conditions safer. They won't do that if they're going to get lathered with it in the courtroom. Or as a friend of mine who works for an insurance company says, the truth is no good deed goes unpunished. Right? Yeah. If you make a change for the better, someone will say, that proves you weren't doing it well up to now. It's a $64.
You're talking about what the jury can hear.
Right.
But that kind of information, is that relevant when you're deciding what charge to make? Or is it relevant when they decide what damages to assess?
Yes.
So it's just at the point of what the jury hears.
Absolutely. It may figure in earlier on. It may figure in at the level of how the parties are going to settle the case. Okay. But not when the jury's going to hear about it. Now, the other one I want to talk about is a word you probably hear a lot, and that's the word hearsay. Well, the jury can't hear this. It's hearsay. Almost every legal show you watch, somebody's talking about hearsay. Let me do a little bit of background. And this is the whole problem with witnesses. I want us to assume a case. We got a witness on the stand named Mickey. Okay? And Mickey is testifying in an automobile case. And his testimony is going to be that at a given point in time and space, the traffic light was red. So we'll depict that here with Mickey's testimony. The light was red. Our hope, of course, is that this testimony matches an actual reality out there, and that is that the light was red. Notice there was an event. The light was either red or it was green or it was yellow or something else. Okay? Our hope is that Mickey's testimony will accurately depict for the jury, so they know the right facts, whether or not the light was red or green. Well, what are the dangers that there will be a variance between the event and the testimony? This is called the problem of testimonial risks. And generally, what we can do is classify the various risks of our getting bad testimony into these categories. First risk, we'll call the risk of perception. That is, Mickey could have seen it wrong. Okay. We all know psychologists tell us all the time how bad human perception is, how much it's affected by distractors, how bad we really are at remembering things. I've often done experiments in the class where we would stage someone running into the class and doing something. I staged an arrest last year. Okay. I had campus police run in and arrest one of our black law students. So I knew that this was going to be very upsetting. I arranged with all of them ahead of time. There was no problem. This did not come as a surprise to the participants. But because the police officers were both white and the student was black, we were building in a lot of tension into this situation. And then we asked the students a series of questions about what they saw. And then, a week later, I asked them the questions again as to what they saw. Interesting thing. What they saw immediately after was pretty bad. A lot of them got it wrong. Five of them had a white woman being arrested. That's pretty far, right? I tested them a week later, and the interesting thing was a lot of the answers changed. They had come together. Almost everybody now, whereas they all saw it differently the first time, they all saw it together now. What does that tell us? They've been talking to each other. They now have a joint story about what happened. Whenever you hear a lawyer talking about how long were you able to see this, were you wearing your glasses, how light was it, this and that, they're all trying to get at the risk of did the witness misperceive the event that he's now telling us about. Second, a whole collection of risks surrounding memory. It's often a very long time between the happening of the event and the reporting of it. They have investigated 800 since the time of this one and the trial. Easy to confuse them. A lot of them look kind of the same. Right? Usually they're helped a little bit by having their report that they can refer to, but even there, there's a memory problem. So that's two things that could go wrong. Bad perception by the witness. Witness doesn't remember it right. The third risk is a collection of things that we'll call narrational risks. That is, in the telling of the story, there may be disjuncture between what Mickey means and what the jury takes from it. Mickey could, for example, misspeak. He could say the light was green, and he could think he's saying red. If you ask him later, he'd swear he said red, but what he said was green. Sometimes we don't recognize that we're saying something that we're not saying, and psychologists tell us that usually what we put in its place is its opposite. That's usually what sneaks in. The word not is a great one. We're sure we said not, and it turns out we didn't, or vice versa.
Do witnesses have a tendency to get nervous up there?
You bet. You bet. It's a terrible situation for many persons to have, so they're under great pressure already. The other part of the narrational problem is not just misspeaking, but using terms that they think means one thing that the jury think means another thing. In other words, language is ambiguous. So a wonderful example of this, a case where a little girl was hurt, an 8-year-old girl was hurt, and suing the defendant, and there was a witness on the stand who was an eyewitness to the case, but was also a neighbor of the little girl and a friend of the little girl. They knew the family and everything else. And she was hurt, her leg was hurt. And the lawyer for the other side, after all the testimony, walked up to this witness and said, at the end of the day, isn't the bare truth you want this plaintiff to recover? And the man looked at her and said, of course. They sat down. The lawyer sat down triumphant. The lawyer had gotten what he wanted. Although, what's happened here? People have assigned different meanings to the word recovery. The little girl was hurt. The man wanted her to recover.
Yeah.
That's what he meant, and that's what the jury heard. We find out later. To a lawyer, recover means get money. So you have that whole problem. And so a lot of times on cross-examination, that's why cross-examination is so tedious. Right? Don't you just say, get on with it. They've got a million questions. These darn lawyers, they never stop. Right? Goodbye. Haven't we been over this? It's to get at that. Sometimes you find out the fourth time you ask the question that the witness is really giving you favorable testimony. You just couldn't get through the thicket of words that that the witness was using.
No. Well, yes.
Yes, I'm not quite that dramatic. So we've got Mickey could have seen the light wrong. Mickey could have misremembered what color the light was, and now there may be something in the telling of it that the jury gets wrong. And then the fourth, and what's usually considered to be the most significant risk, is we'll call the risk over sincerity. That is, Mickey might just not be telling us the truth. Right? He might have all kind of motives not to tell us the truth, but we don't know necessarily what they are. But we have to admit that human beings don't always tell the truth. And that, so a lot of cross-examination, of course, has to do with this sincerity risk. Now, let me make it clear, this is always true. Every time a witness testifies, whether it's an expert witness, a fact witness, a party, all of these risks are there. And if we wanted to say, we'd like to have evidence that doesn't have these risks, let me tell you, there's none. Even scientific tests require human beings to interpret them for us. And so they depend at some level on the believability of a witness. So an expert who runs a test, we have to believe that the expert can read the equipment, and remember what he read, and tell us in a way we can understand, and isn't lying about what was found. So how do we get at this? Well, the law basically gets at this in three ways. First, it gets at it by administering an oath to a witness. So a witness is told immediately, this is not street corner talk. You're not being told at a local mall. What do you think about it? What do you think about the insanity defense? It's one of my favorites. You take that one to a local mall. Oh, let's abolish it. Let's get rid of it. Everybody, you know, nobody's really insane, it's just some smart lawyer. This is what 92% of the American people say when you poll them in shopping malls. Now, let me ask you this question. And we got anybody here who's pretty good at math or statistics? Okay. What's the likelihood, since there's only 8% of the population, who believe in the insanity defense at all, what's the statistical likelihood of getting 12 of them and only 12 of them on a jury? That is, by random draw, how often will you get all 12 fitting into 8%? And that indicates that we'll never get an acquittal on insanity, right? The problem is, we do see some. Way more than that, not as much as the press tells us, but we do see a few. What that means is that people in a moment of high political seriousness, when they're on a jury, don't think the same way as they do if you just ask them on the street corner. And part of the way we get that over to a witness is through the administration of the oath. And we threaten them with perjury and jail and all that. But we also tell them that this is serious and we expect you to tell the truth. We put that together with presence in a courtroom. Just the setting of a courtroom goes a long way to, and I've seen a lot of witnesses, they're very garrulous when you talk to them, you interview them, oh, I'll say this, I'll say that, and I'll do blah, blah, blah. And they get in the courtroom, well, I can't say that. Guy with a robe, right? 12 people, very stern. The other lawyer over there, pen poised. Suddenly the presence in the courtroom, the solemnity of the whole thing. Sometimes, as you indicate, sir, it works too much. People get to the point where they're so burdened by it that they can hardly speak at all. I always try to tell my students, you know, that they're going to reach a point where they go into courtrooms so often that they forget what it's like for the litigants to go into it when it's their case and maybe for the first time. It's, for many of them, really an unbelievably powerful experience. And some of them can hardly get through it. I had a wonderful client. She fell in what we would now call a discount store. It was called Two Guys from Harrison out east in those days. And they had an unsafe condition and she fell. And she was willing to settle this case for like $200. Finally, Allstate was the insurance company. That they weren't going to offer anything. I thought it was about a $15,000 case. And she testified, and she got all done testifying. She did a very nice job. And now Allstate, we had a break, and Allstate now offered us $15,000 after her testimony. This letter went over, and I said, I want $15,000. She said, nope, we're going to the jury. I want more. I said, you were willing to take $200 yesterday. She said, yeah, but I've testified now. That's what I was afraid of. So I got through it. I got through it. She was willing to trade off all this money. She didn't have to go through it. Now she's through it. To heck with them. She got $32,000.
Yeah.
32. Yay! So we got oath and presence and cross-examination. Is the third. Is the third, and you put them together, and you see they spell cop, of course, that's the little game here. So what we say is, this is how we police testimony to try to get it as truthful as we can, by putting people under oath, by creating a setting in a courtroom, which is very powerful, and by giving the lawyer for the other side the power to ask all of these questions. Now, what does that have to do with hearsay? Here's the problem. Let's say that what we're doing is not having Mickey tell us that the light was red. What Mickey is going to do is to tell us that Marilyn told him that the light was red. So let's put Marilyn here. These are all stick people. That's because I have no artistic capabilities. So we'll give Marilyn a little hair here. This is Marilyn. This is either Marilyn's hair or a very bad hat. Sorry about that. And now let's change this. Here's the event out here, where the light is either red or green. And now what we have in the middle is a statement. Marilyn's statement to Mickey. So what happens is, Marilyn sees the light. Several weeks later, she's talking to her friend Mickey, and she says, I saw that accident down at Main and Fifth, and you know, the controlling light was red. Now, Mickey didn't see the accident. Mickey knows nothing about the accident. Now, when we come to trial, the lawyer calls Mickey, and he says, did you have a conversation with Marilyn on a particular date? Yes, I did. Did she talk about the accident she had witnessed 2 weeks before? Yes, she did. Did she tell you what color the light was at the time?
Object.
Yes, she did. What did she say?
Object.
Object? What's your objection?
Hearsay.
It's hearsay. Okay. In other words, Mickey is not going to testify to something that Mickey has firsthand knowledge of. Mickey is going to report a statement from another person who in turn has firsthand knowledge. Here's the hearsay problem. You will notice that Mickey could have heard the statement wrong. Could have misheard Marilyn, or he could misremember what Marilyn said, or he could misnarrate it to us, or he could lie about what she said. These four risks are present, but these four risks are covered because Mickey is in court. And he's a witness, and we got him under oath, and we're going to cross-examine him. Right? The problem is, notice that there's four more risks out here. First of all, Marilyn could have misperceived what color the light was. And if she misperceives what color the light was, she's going to make a misstatement to Mickey. And the jury's going to end up getting it wrong. Or, by the time she talked to Mickey, her memory is confused. Or, she misnarrates when she talks to Mickey. Or, she's lying. So now we have eight risks. Any one of eight things could go wrong, and the jury will get it wrong by the time if you let this worry you too much, you'll wonder how the jury can ever get anything right. There's just too many things that can go wrong. What hearsay, though, says is, of course, all of these things could be wrong. But at least with Mickey, since he's on the stand, subject to cross-examination and under oath, we can get at these. We may not get at it, but we have some vehicles to try to see if he's lying. if he had, if he perceived it right. But what about these risks over here? How do we get at those? Marilyn's not in the courtroom. Marilyn's not a witness. So if we say to Mickey, how close was Marilyn to the accident? What's he been telling us?
I don't know.
So I don't know. I just know she told me. Well, maybe she misremembered. Well, maybe. I don't know. But that's what she told me. The definition of hearsay is whenever we have an out-of-court statement, this is Marilyn's statement here, the light was red, and we're offering it to prove that what was said was true, that is, we need to know whether or not Marilyn had it right, then we've got hearsay. So the jury's not going to get to hear what Marilyn said unless we do what? Get Marilyn in there. You know, if you simply get Marilyn in as a witness, then we can put Marilyn on the stand, and we can go through all of these risks by cross-examining Marilyn, putting her under oath, etc. One of the problems, of course, is that sometimes the Marilyns of the world can't be found, or they've died, or they've left, or all kind of other things. And the law is certainly not that you can never use hearsay. There are certain kind of situations where the law will permit hearsay in because the necessity of it and because the kind of statement that was made seems to us to be particularly reliable. Okay? Are there any exceptions? Yes, there are 37 known hearsay exceptions. So this takes us about 5 weeks in the evidence class to go through it. But let me give you some of them. And I know we have some theologians in the room. I want to see what they think of some of them. One hearsay exception, one case in which you're allowed to get hearsay in, is if the out-of-court statement was a dying declaration. That it was a statement made while believing that death was imminent. Why should we accept that as hearsay?
Because we assume that they would not lie on their deathbed.
Yeah, right. That there's something about once this, we know that this is a statement made at the end of death, all of the usual motivations for lying appear to be gone. The person at that point has every reason to tell the truth, to come clean. Is that true? Fred?
I'm trying to think of instances where people lied on their deathbed.
Protect somebody else, I think it's...
Yeah, to protect somebody else. If they're talking about who owns what property, there may be some sort of inheritance sort of motivations to lie going on. But I think usually the ordinary solution to it is probably right. But those are pretty trustworthy statements. And, of course, the other powerful thing going on in those cases is that the speaker is dead. Right? And so there's huge necessity. It's not as if here we can say, why'd you call Mickey? Just call Marilyn. Well, we know why we can't call the declarant of that statement. Yeah, Mark?
Does that count, like, with prisoners who are, like, on death row?
Uh-huh. Oh,
yeah.
If the... The dying declaration, though, is fairly limited.
Like it has to be like that minute, like when they're dying, not the preceding.
It has to connect. In other words, the statement has to be a statement about what's producing their death.
Okay.
So it can't be a statement about things that are unrelated. But a lot of the dying declarations are the name of the person who shot them. That kind of thing, yeah. So it's connected to the death itself. Here's another one: an excited utterance. This is my favorite one. If some read you the rule the way lawyers write it here to make sure you can't understand it. This used to be called a spontaneous declaration, and now under the new code, it's an excited utterance. A statement relating to a startling event or condition made while the declarant was under the stress of excitement caused by the event or condition. So you see something that's very startling, you go, oh, the lawnmower is on fire! That would come in. Any one of you could go to court and testify that Berner looked out the window and screamed, oh my God, the lawnmower is on fire. fact, we tell law students that you can always tell an excited utterance because it always begins with the words, "Oh my God." Right. Oh my God, the love moves on. Why should that come in? What is there about an excited utterance?
You're uninhibited.
Yeah. It's immediate.
Very difficult to lie.
Yeah, that's the real key. If this is the worst risk, that is the risk of sincerity. The idea is that the stuff you say under a startling event, say it immediately. There's no time to form the motivation to lie and to lie.
Right? But I would think that what would be at question there is perception.
Absolutely, and that's why these things are never all one way. While it is true that in excited utterances the sincerity risk is way down, the perception risk may be up, because if the event is really a startling condition, the more startling it is, the less we know that people's perception tends to work. So
I swear it was some kind of a rocket, or all the sightings kinds of things.
Yeah. UFO.
Right. Yeah, UFOs. And,
When people make statements against their own interest, those are always accepted as hearsay. So if I admit to something, that will be usable as hearsay. Why? Because people aren't in the habit of being insincere against their own interest. That is, the assumption is that when people are lying, they're lying for self-interest. Not always true. There are some mental illnesses that take the form of lying against your interest. Right? But generally speaking, when people say, the accident was my fault. See, if you're in an accident, that's one, we always say to people, why do you speak after you're in these accidents? Why do you say these things? Because that's the kind of thing they say. We were at fault. I was going too fast. That's going to come in. That's hearsay, but it's an admission against interest, so that kind of thing will come in. And you can argue that if you're the lawyer for that person may have said, "I'm sorry, this was my fault," out of a motivation wholly apart from the legal one, "I was negligent." In fact, the most ambiguous one of all is, "I'm sorry." "I'm sorry" isn't the same as "I caused this" or "I apologize for this." You can be sorry when you cause something that isn't your fault. Right? So that one's a little bit tricky. Business records are another form of hearsay that always come in, and a few others. Let me just stop and see what questions people have at this point about anything they heard where the jury didn't get to hear something. The biggest question, if you want to chew on one, I'll give you one last one to think about here, is the character evidence problem. I want you to imagine that the defendant's on trial for burglary, criminal case for burglary. 3 years ago, the defendant was convicted of burglary and served a 6-month sentence. Should the jury know that? Same crime, 3 years ago.
Well, the problem is, this burglary occurs, and the police say, "What burglars do we know about? It might have been that guy."
So round up the usual suspect.
Yeah.
Right? Right? So that could be. The state, of course, has an obligation to prove that he burglarized this time. But, evidence, as McCormick says, a brick is not a wall. You can't expect each piece of evidence to prove the whole case. You build your case brick by brick. And here's a brick. We saw him, this, and he committed burglary 3 years ago. Here's one more thing to throw into the equation. And there is, of course, statistically, you can demonstrate almost in every state that someone who has committed a burglary in the past is more likely to commit one in the future than someone who has never committed one in the past. That is to say, there is a real empirical connection between them. But what's the danger?
Prejudgment.
Yeah, the danger is that the jury loses sight of the issue, which is, did he burglarize this house this time? And they replace it with, hey, it's a bad guy. Let's convict him even if he didn't do it this time. See, so the good use of the past conviction is people who do it in the past have some slight increased statistical likelihood to do it now. The bad use is for the jury to say, we don't care if he did it now. He's just a bad person. And since he did it in the past, and the other one that I've actually heard jurors say is, well, maybe he didn't do this one, but I'm sure he did some stuff we're not even aware of.
So we got three strikes.
Yeah. Well, that's a sentencing thing. In other words, after the third conviction for unrelated felony, they hike the sentence way up. Yeah.
I've got a question about witnesses on the stand. I don't know if this happens in real life or if it's just the kind of thing that I've seen on movies or whatever, but you've got a witness on the stand, let's just say, you know, and then you've got opposing counsel that's conducting the cross-examination, and they will ask a question that is carefully crafted to be a yes or no answer.
Right.
And yet, the witness, knowing something about the event or whatever, knows that giving a yes or no answer, whether they answer yes or no, it's not really the truth.
And they will struggle to not answer yes or no. They will struggle to
right.
give a middle answer.
And sometimes the judge will even direct the witness to answer the question. And I wonder about that because I think that if I was in that situation, I would feel obligated to my oath more than to answering the question and any rules of procedure in the courtroom. If my oath is to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, that I would refuse to answer yes or no. Is that legitimate?
The truth, the whole truth, basically, which is usually the way the oath is stated, we're usually talking there about direct examination. That is when the lawyer who called you is walking you through your testimony of what happened. Cross-examination gets a little bit different. And what's supposed to happen there is that the cross-examiner is entitled to restrict the witness to certain forms of answers like yes and no. Because, you know, some witnesses want to explain everything in a long explanation. But then what should happen if both lawyers are doing what they're supposed to do is the lawyer who called you now gets another shot at you on what's called redirect. And it's at that point where if you gave some answers that the jury might mistake because they're yes, no, they'll say, well, you were forced to answer yes or no to this. Tell us more about that. That's the point then. So many things at trials that people, when people see it, they say, that doesn't seem right. What's really happening is, no, it isn't right if that's the whole picture. We're going to take care of what you're worried about, but just not here. The structure of the trial says, it's not your turn. When it's your turn, you can get it. And a lot of the rules are really rules about whose turn it is and when they can. And there's a lot of great questions, and law students learn the law, of course, that can be put in a yes-no way that there is no good answer. My favorite one is in a slip-and-fall case. Plaintiff slips and falls outside of someone's store. They sue the store owner. Here's the question you ask the plaintiff. Did you see what you slipped on it before you slipped on it? Now, you see, if the answer to that is yes, then the obvious is, well, why did you step on it? And if the answer is no, then the question is, why weren't you looking? Yeah, so there's, you know, how'd you stop beating your wife? That's sort of the famous, that's more a question of sort of the form of the question. We cover that in evidence too. Strategically, how do you go about doing it? Well, the overall concept we try to give the students in a course called Trial Advocacy, which is the second course in the sequence. This just gives them the rules of evidence. This is the rules of how to play. The Trial Advocacy course tells them, how do you conduct the trial? And the basic idea here is that, I wish Walt were here, because we'll talk a little bit about this. A trial is a type of story. And good trial lawyers know that what they're doing is telling a story to the jury, but it's a story that's constrained with a lot of rules. It's like writing certain kind of poetry, like a haiku or a sonnet. You're free to write any story you want, provided it's 14 lines long, and this rhymes with that, and this goes here. In other words, it's a form in which to tell a story. And the form for this story is set forth in this book called The Federal Rules of Evidence. Here's how you can and can't tell the story. But students don't get that sometimes. I mean, once when they first start, they want to say, okay, I'm the defendant. Great old British case went this way. A guy is charged with borrowing my coffee cup and returning it. When he returned it, the handle was broken. And he has three defenses. I didn't borrow it. It was broken when I borrowed it. And it wasn't broken when I returned it. Law students know he can make each of those arguments, because I have the burden of proof of showing all those three things, and he can simply deny them all. But when the jury is there, he has to have a story. He can't go before the jury and say, I didn't borrow it, it was broken when I borrowed it, it wasn't broken when I returned it. And the jury goes, you know, liar. Liar? See, lawyers call that arguing in the alternative. Ordinary people know it as lying. So you have to. We're done for the paper. But thanks very much.
Arguing in the alternative.